Silence followed. "What do you mean, destroyed?" Farmer Whedon asked.
"These men," he gestured toward the strangers, "are from Nadak. 5 days ago, they saw smoke in the north. They crossed into the highlands of Dorea, but the doll was gone. Men, women, and children butchered. Their lodge and all the outlying villages are nothing more than burned-out shells. Only the wind left to howl."
The entire hall murmured in disbelief. No words followed, only gasps and curses, which died on stunned lips.
"How many survived?" Tope asked. "Duraeans?" Conniger took a long breath. "None. Even the livestock were slaughtered."
"How do we know it was the gods?" Delwyn asked. "Maybe it was the Gularoons."
The men near the door shook their heads. One with a black leather band wound around his forehead said,
"The bodies were in neat rows, as if they'd been lined up to die. And their weapons had been left. Nothing was taken. Nothing looted. Everything was burned."
More murmurs.
"So, maybe it was the gods, but Dorea was attacked because Wraith, this god-killer, is from there. We haven't done anything to offend the gods. We don't bother them, and they won't bother us, right?"
Delwyn said in a tone that sounded more like a wish than a declaration. He had an arm around his wife, Sarah, pulling her close.
"This has nothing to do with us."
"But what if it does?" Gifford asked. "What if the gods, maybe they don't see a difference between Dorea and us?"
Gifford, using R words in public, indicated more than idle concern.
"Tell them what you saw this morning, Tope."
Heads turned to the haggard farmer, who wiped his face with a grain sack he usually used as a hat.
"I saw smoke to the northwest, right up the valley road. Looked like it was coming from Nadak."
An ominous silence froze the room. The men from Nadak stared at Tope. Then the questions came.
"How much smoke? When was this?
What color was the smoke?"
Each voice sounded more concerned than the one before.
"Was a lot of smoke. Black smoke," Tope said. "You can still see it if you climb to the top of the Horn Ridge."
Hearing this, the strangers rushed out. The rest watched them go into a deceptively pleasant spring day.
"That doesn't prove anything," Delwyn said,
but he pulled Sarah closer and placed a hand on his daughter's head.
"Sounds like the Fwey punished them too," Gifford said. "If they come, what's we going to do?"
"What do you mean, do?" Conniger asked. "What is there to do?"
Several of the faces in the hall looked surprised. Conniger hadn't exhibited much intelligence over the years, and Persephone figured he didn't understand the question. She pushed up to her knees.
"I think they want to know what steps you plan to take to prevent what happened to Dorea, and possibly Nadak, from happening here."
Her comment drew a sharp look from Tressa, whose lips pulled taut.
"There's nothing to do," Conniger replied. "It won't happen here. We've done nothing wrong."
"But if a Frey has been killed, then..." Delwyn started.
"We didn't kill him," Conniger said, cutting him off. "They have no reason to bother us."
Tressa smirked.
"Dorayans have always caused trouble. Serves them right. I call it justice. They brought the wrath of the divine down on themselves. But we have nothing to fear."
"What about Nadak?" Gifford asked. "What did they do?"
"We don't know anything about Nadak," Conniger said, then nodded at his wife and drew himself up straighter.
Not the best way to start, Persephone thought. She knew firsthand how difficult it could be, making decisions while everyone watched. When people were scared and looking for someone to take that fear away, it was a mistake to leave them idle to speculate and worry.
But there are still some things we can do, yes? Persephone asked.
So much for being quiet and invisible. How long did that last? 5 minutes? But 5 minutes ago, Dorea and Nadak still existed.
All eyes shifted between the new chieftain and the old chieftain's widow.
Just say yes. Say, of course. And if you can't think of anything, ask me later when no one is looking. But don't leave them lost.
Conniger declared, There are things beyond the control of men, and the will of gods is one of them.
Seriously?
I agree. We can't control what the gods will do, Persephone said, but we aren't helpless either. We could send a delegation to Alan Rist, explaining how we had nothing to do with the actions of Duraeans. We could send messengers to the other dolls, like the men of Nadak who came here. We should let others know what's going on. At the very least, we should send someone to Nadak to check out the smoke Tope saw. Maybe they weren't attacked. Maybe they just had a fire that got out of control. If Nadak has also been destroyed, that's much different than if it was only Dorea. We need to know for sure, as that information significantly changes what we should do.
Persephone!
Tressa interceded for her husband, straightening in the chair as she spoke.
We grieve for your loss, but Reglan is dead, and Conniger is the chieftain. I think your voice would best serve the doll by being silent.
Persephone would have ignored the verbal slap if Tressa hadn't mentioned Reglan. At least, that was what she told herself afterward. Instead, she said,
If you were paying attention, Tressa, you'd know I wasn't speaking to you.
Conniger patted his wife's hand, probably to diffuse the tension in the room. And if we find out Nadak has been attacked, and if no one at Alan Rist will talk to us, what then?
If this is true, if the gods have declared war and won't negotiate a peace, we need to gather what we can and leave.
Leave! He said the word as if he'd never heard it before.
And go where?
Having me give you all the answers in front of a crowd is no way to instill confidence.
Persephone had hoped Conniger could find his way if she pointed him in the right direction. Apparently that was wishful thinking.
At this point, I'd say south is a good direction. I'd aim for Dol Tyr to give us as much time as possible to...
To what? Conniger asked. In Tyr, we'd have our backs to the sea, without walls or food. And do you think Tyr would welcome us? Such an invasion would spark a clan war. And for what? If the gods are after us, what would a few more miles matter?
The time to organize and prepare.
For what?
For war, Persephone said.
A collective gasp escaped from those in the meeting hall. For a few minutes, no one said anything. Tressa was the one who broke the silence.
Are you listening to yourself? You want to declare war against gods?
She lifted her sight to address the assembly.
Do we take up spears against the grandmother of all for not sending sufficient rain? The finest warriors of this village couldn't defeat a bear, and Persephone expects us to make war with the Frey.
Conniger shot his wife a harsh glance she didn't see, then said,
If the Frey are set against us, then there is nothing that can be done. Men can't kill gods.
The God-Killer did,
Persephone answered.
That's just a rumor, Conniger replied.
Why else would the Frey destroy Dorea?
They used Dorians to fight the Gularoons. What else could have angered them enough to turn against allies? If killing a Frey is possible, we need to find the man who knows how to do it. Then, if we can draw all the clans together, including the Gula, we could... Conagher shook his head.
It's impossible to unite the clans. The Gula hate us as much as we hate them.
It's not impossible, Persephone replied. Ask Maeve, she'll tell you. Generations ago, during the Great Flood, Garth of Odion united the clans, all the clans. Isn't that right?
Maeve nodded, but didn't speak.
Under his leadership, our people built boats, Persephone said for her. We filled them with supplies, and when the waters rose, we set sail and began a new life. Well, this is a new flood, a new disaster. We need to harness the combined strength and wisdom of all our people to survive. When we send messengers to the other Dals to tell them about Nadak and Dorea, we could ask other chieftains to bring their people to meet in Tyre as well.
You want to abandon everything we've worked hundreds of years to build because the gods saw fit to punish the Doraeans for killing one of them?
Tressa asked, and shook her head, her face bitter.
Conagher sat back, stroking his beard and shifting his eyes, while deep in thought. After a few minutes, he straightened and said,
No, such drastic measures aren't warranted. You're overreacting. Tressa is right. We have it good here, better than most Dals, and leaving a place of comfort for the unknown is foolish. You are worried about something that will never come to pass.
Several in the hall were nodding now. Persephone had seen this before. If given a choice between a potentially great hardship and doing nothing, people gravitated toward what was most familiar and comfortable. That was why leadership was needed, to do what was necessary rather than what was easy. Persephone had a history of advocating unpopular ideas and arguing with chieftains. Reglan used to say it was her best and worst trait. If the potential danger weren't so great, if the repercussions of getting this wrong weren't so dire, she would have left it at that. Instead, she said,
But what if it does? Then it will be too late. If we...
Conagher slapped the arm of his chair.
Tyre won't tolerate us on their doorstep. We'd be as welcome as locusts. Will they share their food? Will there even be enough?
Conagher's voice had lowered to an angry growl. Maeve finally interceded.
Persephone,
she began, clasping her hands and taking a step forward.
Garth of Odion was renowned even before the Flood. Heroes like him no longer walk among us. He was able to win the support of every chieftain. Gathering the clans will do nothing without someone to lead. I fear the chieftains won't kneel before anyone less.
Conagher glanced at the broadaxe he had lodged in the winter pillar.
I've fought and killed to become chieftain of this clan. I can't take a knee to any man from Menahan, Melon, Tyre, or Warwick. The decision is mine, and I say we stay here. This discussion is over, and I'll hear no more on the subject.
Maeve locked eyes with Persephone. The old woman shook her head ever so slightly.
Maeve wouldn't support her.
Persephone couldn't oppose both the chieftain and the Keeper of Ways. Looking around, she saw less anxiety than at the start of the meeting. When she had been talking about leaving, she had seen the eyes of rabbits staring back at her, scared and wanting nothing more than to hide in their burrows. The people feared a mass exodus more than they did the gods. She wondered if even Reglan would have listened to her. Conagher was right about one thing.
It was far easier to do nothing than to brave the unknown. She sat back down. The meeting had concluded with the usual prayer to Mera, the goddess of Ren, and to Elan, the grandmother of all. Persephone filed out with the rest, feeling utterly alone in a crowd of people. Avoiding stairs, she walked around the north side of the lodge, away from most of the homes, and toward the open space left behind by the depleted woodpile. There she saw the young mystic again.
"Almost got him that time,"
Suri told the wolf, whose head was stuffed in a gap between the logs, scratching the dirt and trying to push deeper.
"You've lost him now. You're too big to fit in there."
The girl was kneeling on the grass, in front of the 5-foot-high, double-row pile of stacked wood, all that remained of the doll's winter supply. Both the wolf's and Suri's heads popped up as Persephone approached. The girl frowned.
"Don't tell me there's a rule against wolves hunting rats in woodpiles."
"Is there?"
"What?"
"No," Persephone replied. "There are rules against everything else. What you can and can't eat, or where you can sleep, even where to squat in the morning. Everyone here is touched, there's no mistake. But I suppose that's what you get from living inside a wall."
"Tura always said walls were bad. Said the same thing about shoes."
Suri looked down at her bare feet.
"I didn't understand Tura's scorn of either, until now."
Not knowing how to respond, Persephone simply said,
"You're still here." "Your eyes still work,"
the girl answered with a grin. If Suri were a normal person, Persephone would have been insulted. Normal person. Already she had branded the new mystic bizarre. New mystic, new chieftain. There were altogether too many news on the doll lately.
"Strange game, this stating the obvious," Suri said, shaking her head.
She got up and joined Mina at the woodpile.
"Pointless, but popular. Everyone plays it. You're eating our bread. That isn't your bed. You have a wolf.
But as you can see, I'm getting the knack of it.
Tura told me to blend in at villages, especially the dolls. She said people who live inside walls are crazy and can be dangerous. Touched animals are too. Cursed by the gods, sort of like you. And even a tainted squirrel's bite can make you that way.
I merely meant..." "Well..." Persephone hesitated.
"I didn't think you'd still be here."
Suri pointed at the treetops visible over the rear wall of the doll, where the grey spears had become a curtain of green.
"Was waiting on the leaves."
Persephone laughed.
"It's been 2 weeks."
The mystic twisted her face, thinking hard.
"You have 2 ears.
She smiled proudly. "I'm starting to see the fun of this. Using a part of what another person says makes it harder, doesn't it? Probably gets more challenging late in winter when you've been sealed up for months. I assume you can't repeat the same thing twice, right?" Persephone rolled her eyes. Suri looked perplexed.
"Does everyone here suffer from this eye sickness as well? I've seen a lot of that."
"I'm sure you have," Persephone thought.
A pattering sound from the depths of the woodpile sent the wolf thrusting back into the crevice, her claws skittering on the stripped bark, littering the stack's perimeter. She sprayed the torn shards across the yard. Suri sighed.
"Mina, you're still too big."
Bizarre might have been an understatement. Persephone decided to get to the point.
"When we spoke, you mentioned something bad was going to happen. What did you mean?"
"What do you mean, what did I mean?" Persephone faltered. It hadn't been this difficult talking with Tura. Not that Persephone had seen her much. Mystics rarely came to the doll, and when they did, It wasn't to proclaim, "Everything is going to be cream and honey from now on." Persephone hadn't seen Tura since the season before the Great Famine.
"I mean, well, your prediction sounded implausible at the time, but two of the nearby dolls have been attacked, and I think I should listen to what you have to say."
"I told you, Mom. I don't know exactly, but the signs were clear."
Plucking bark off one of the logs, she tasted it, then spat and tossed the strip aside.
"What signs?"
"Near sunset on the first day of spring, I saw lightning in the northwest. The thunder startled a flock of crows that took flight, also in the northwest. The wind was blowing west to east, and a moment later, the sun was blocked out by dark clouds."
"And what does that mean?"
Sori sighed.
"Okay, listen. The sun is born in the east, so the east is good. West is bad. That's where the sun goes to die. When signs happen in the west, those are bad omens. Lightning is a judgment of the gods, powerful and violent. Birds are extremely significant, often used as messengers of the gods. And since I saw a whole flock, it means a lot of people will suffer."
"Blocking out the sun? Well, even you ought to understand that's not a good turn of events."
"Any one of these signs could have been serious, but all three..."
"Bad news. Very bad news."
"But you can't tell me exactly what will happen."
"Unlike your word game, the gods aren't so obvious, which makes their games a lot more interesting to play. I mean, if Elan came right out and said tomorrow you'll take a walk and be ripped apart by badgers, you'd be terrified and wouldn't go out, right? So she wouldn't tell you that. She might drop some hints, but if you didn't pick up on the clues or couldn't figure them out, well, that's not really her fault. Anyway, you go walking into a horrible badger-ripping death because you didn't know any better. That's the way the gods play their games, and why I think we need to talk to the trees, so we aren't all ripped apart by badgers."
"So very odd.
Then we can change fate." The girl shrugged as her attention once again was drawn to the wolf and the woodpile.
"And how will the trees help?"
Sori let out a long sigh.
"Mina, did you hear that? I'm starting to see what Tura meant about people living in the walls. Mom, haven't you ever talked to a tree?"
"Very, very odd."
"I can't say I have. Do you speak to them?"
"Some," the girl said, and then stuck her head into a gap between the logs, as if testing her chance of crawling in.
It was the wolf's turn to watch with amusement.
"Some? Not all trees like to talk,"
Sori said, her voice muffled by the woodpile.
"Beeches are famous for being unfriendly. They never say a word. Stubborn as can be. You can feel a sense of superiority with them."
She pulled her head out of the cordwood and delivered a sympathetic frown to the wolf, followed by a hopeless shrug.
"Now, a locust, laurel, or holly, well, you can't get them to shut up, but they don't know anything. They just chatter. Silly gossip, mostly. Willows are notorious for going on. And trust me, you don't want to talk to them. Mind-numbingly depressing."
Sori dragged out the words like heavy things. Persephone gave her a skeptical look.
Seeing it, the girl added in a quiet voice, "Seriously, people have drowned themselves after spending too much time under a willow. Which makes you wonder about the gods' motives for putting them near water as often as they do."
She waited, but Persephone remained silent, so Sori continued.
"Elms tend to be proud and snooty. Maples are vain. Look at my leaves, look at my leaves. Never talk to a maple in autumn. Unbearable. You can warn them all you want, you know. You remind them winter is coming and what it means, but they won't listen.
Maples have all the memory of a raindrop, which is weird for a tree, don't you think? Now, evergreens, like spruce and cedar, they're nice enough. Most of them are soft-spoken. A cedar on the West Ridge knew right where the wind had blown my hat last summer. Every so often you'll find a really sweet old pine. Dear Wogan, you can lose a few days curled up at their feet while sipping needle tea, which they're quite proud of, but honestly tastes pretty awful. They'll prattle on about the good old days when the summers were sweeter and the rains wetter.
And if I wanted to know what the omens you saw meant, Persephone asked, if I needed advice about the intentions of gods, which would I ask?
Oh, there's only one tree worth talking to for that. Magda, the old oak.
Where is this oak?
Suri hooked her thumb over her shoulder. There's a glen at the base of the high forest, in the fingers of the mountain. She holds court there.
Holds court?
Oh, yes. Magda's highly revered by the other trees. Bushes and plants, too. They all keep a respectable distance and bow before her. It's easy to see why. She's... well... she's Magda. Oldest tree in the forest. And the crescent is an old forest.
Persephone stared out at the tree-thick hills, which rose well above the level of the doll's wall. The ridges rolled on, fold upon fold, each a different shade of green drifting toward blue. The crescent forest hugged Dol Ren, providing precious gifts of wood and food, but remained a mysterious world fraught with terrors. Dense groves of old trees, caves, and rivers were known to be gateways to the spirit world, and the crescent had all of them. Persephone had lain in the lodge on many summers' night, listening to the frightening sounds entering the open window, shrieks and cries, cracks and thumps that could have no mortal origin. The crescent was a noisy neighbor you knew was up to no good. To live in Dol Ren was to dwell on the brink of a leafy abyss. Persephone's gaze followed the ridgeline to the south, where it rose sharply.
They say the bear that killed my husband and son lives on that mountain.
Suri nodded, and her bright smile faded. Persephone was sad to see it go. Something about the girl's cheerful enthusiasm, as odd as it was, made Persephone feel better, hopeful, as if Suri were spring itself, bubbling and budding with possibility. Now the girl appeared serious for the first time. The tattoos around her eyes and mouth added a grave authority, and for a moment Persephone felt a little frightened.
Grin the Brown makes her home in a cave on a cliff near the top of the tree line. Magda isn't nearly so high, but Grin has a tendency to wander, and she has no respect for the old oak. Grin has no respect for anything.
Persephone looked out at the forest.
I need to speak with her. To this tree. Can you take me?
Suri no longer looked at Persephone. Her eyes had shifted to a fluttering butterfly. Persephone waited while Suri watched it land on a sprig of clover. A bright smile filled her face once more.
Did you hear me?
Persephone asked.
Did I hear what, Mom? The girl replied. Can you take me to this old oak, so I can ask her some questions? Do you see the butterfly?
Suri grinned with enthusiasm.
Yes, I see it, but so stunning and delicate, it's marvelous.
No one can see a butterfly and not stop to admire it.
I'd love to be one. To go to sleep and wake up a season later with such beautiful wings and the ability to flutter about. That's the most wonderful sort of magic, don't you think? To change, to grow, to fly. But...
she paused. I wonder what the cost would be.
The smile diminished once more.
There's always a cost when it comes to magic. I suspect there is a great price to go from lowly caterpillar to glorious butterfly. Definitely not a normal person.
Still, Persephone had to admit she liked Suri.
Can you take me to...
Of course I can,
Suri smirked. Why do you think I've risked my sanity, staying in this terrible walled place?
Oh, is this another game?
She turned to her wolf, which was sitting but still eyeing the woodpile.
Can you get that rat, Mina? Would you like me to move the wood so you can catch it?
Suri looked back at Persephone and smiled.
How's that?
Chapter 7 The Black Tree. The Crescent Forest was our neighbor, a place so vast no one knew all its secrets. From its trees, Dalren was built. From its animals, Dalren was fed. And from its darkness, a hero was made. The Book of Brynn.
Wraith and Malcolm were nestled in the eaves of a forest just outside Dalren, a fortified settlement built on a hill and surrounded by a circular wall of logs. The hill itself was dreamlike, so high, so green. Wraith had never seen such lush land. In Dorea, everything was bleached, the only color painted in sunsets. His father had often spoke about Elysian, a paradise where the spirits of brave warriors went after death, a place of green fields, foaming beer, and beautiful women. Seeing Dalren, Wraith wondered if his father had simply heard rumors of this place.
So, that hill is a Dal?
Malcolm asked, sitting with knees up, twiddling a twig between two fingers. Wraith once more marveled at Malcolm's lack of rudimentary knowledge about how people lived. He'd given up asking how Malcolm had become a slave. Any inquiry resulted in vague responses and a change of subject. Wraith concluded Malcolm had either been taken by the Frey as a baby or was born in captivity.
Yes, that's a doll. A little too symmetrical. Did they make it?
Malcolm asked.
Wraith nodded.
Sort of. Comes from centuries of building over previous villages.
He was in the brush, on his knees, and had already trimmed a cross branch, constructed the gateway for the snare, and was working at trying the loop. Usually he had trouble with that last part. His fingers were too big.
After a fire or a raising, people rebuild on top of the rubble. Easier than going someplace new, and the well is already there. Do it enough times, and a mound builds up.
So, Wren is a clan. How many are there altogether?
Malcolm asked.
7, not including the Gularoons.
Why not include them? They're human, too, right?
Rulinroons and Gularoons don't get along.
Wraith finally got a little knot pulled.
We've been warring for centuries.
Are they who your father fought against with the Frey?
Yep. Every year there would be a battle or two, and every decade a full-scale war. My father survived more than 30 years of fighting.
So, how is it he never saw a dead Frey?
The Frey don't bloody their hands. They plan the battles, pick and train the men, then send others off to fight. There were plenty of deaths, but only among the runes.
Malcolm nodded as if he understood, but Wraith knew he didn't. Few did. Even he had a hard time understanding. His father didn't seem to question any of it. Herkimer accepted war as readily as he acknowledged water being wet. But then, Dorea was a different place. Certainly nothing like this.
Usually, the higher the hill, the older the Dal,
Wraith said, looking across the field of sunlight.
That's why it's shaped that way. In a real sense, it's a burial mound. By the look of it, Dalren must be quite old.
The ex-slave reclined, but continued to study the Dal.
It doesn't look that big.
Wraith had been thinking just the opposite. The doll rose majestically in the distance, sun-drenched and luxurious with its abundance of wood.
"It's much bigger than Daldorea, and mammoth when compared with Clempton, the small village where I grew up."
"I lived in Alunrist, remember?" Malcolm said.
He hooked a thumb at the village.
"That's not suitable for a cattle pen when compared with Frey standards. How many people do you think live there?"
Wraith shrugged and tied a second knot into the loop as a precaution. He didn't want his dinner getting away. Nothing was worse than finding an empty sprung trap.
"Here? I don't know. 1,000, maybe?
Where I grew up, we had close to 40 families, about 200 people, but that was a little village, not a doll."
"What's the difference?"
"Dolls are the oldest and most populated village of a given clan. It's where the chieftain has his lodge."
"You know what a lodge is?
What beavers live in?"
Wraith stared at him incredulously.
"Yes, I know what a lodge is," Malcolm said with a smirk.
"Well, you don't seem to know much else."
Malcolm shrugged.
"I never claimed to be smart."
He focused back on the hill.
"So, there's 1,000 people in there."
"Maybe. This place is twice the size of Daldorea."
"How many runes, I'm sorry, humans are there?"
"Including the Gula?"
Malcolm nodded.
Wraith shrugged. "I don't think anyone knows."
Wraith stared up at the great green mound. Morning fires burned inside the wall. He couldn't see the homes, but counted scores of smoke columns rising straight on a windless day. The only structure visible from where they sat was the peaked roof of the lodge. Made of raw logs, it looked huge.
"I don't see why we can't go in," Malcolm said.
"We don't need to. After I finish this snare, we'll go back over to the cascade where we set the others. Hopefully our first rabbit will be waiting for us, so we'll have plenty of fresh water and roast rabbit for supper. It'll go along nicely with the rest of the bread."
"Bread's gone," Malcolm mentioned.
"Gone? All of it?"
"Last night."
"But we only ate a little bit."
"And the night before we had a little. It's not magic bread, you know."
Wraith frowned. He'd been looking forward to rabbit and grease-soaked bread. Thinking about food when he didn't have any was miserable. Malcolm pointed to a flock of sheep barely visible on the far side of the dal. Two men and a pair of dogs urged them up a grassy slope.
"They probably have lamb stew in Dalren. Fresh bread, maybe even milk, eggs, and butter. Bet they're having breakfast right now."
"I love breakfast."
"Are you familiar with the concept?"
"Don't start that again.
If you'd wanted steady meals, you shouldn't have hit Shigon with that rock."
He looked over at Malcolm. "Did he really do those things? Did Shigon feed women to dogs and cut off the hands of a child?"
"No."
Malcolm shook his head.
"Shigon was a self-indulgent, arrogant fool. Most of them are. But he wasn't a monster. He was a hunter. The Instaria are another matter, and they're the ones after us. They're warriors who command the outposts, the tribe charged with keeping order out here on the frontier."
"I thought Alunrist was the home of..."
Wraith stopped before revealing his own ignorance. Malcolm smiled. Not a gloating grin or pretentious smirk, but a look of understanding. Wraith reconsidered his earlier impression about Malcolm resembling a weasel. The man did have a pointed nose and narrow eyes, but other than that he wasn't weasel-like at all.
"No, Alunrist, though far more impressive than that doll over there, is small by Frey standards. The Frey's homeland is Erevan," Malcolm said. "A vast and beautiful country of ancient forests, more than a week's hike to the northeast. It's on the far side of a great river called the Nidwalden. Few Frey ever leave Erevan. Significant portions of their population have never left the capital city of Estremnadon. They see Erevan as the center of the universe, the source of all things good. So there's no point in going anywhere else. Alan Rist is the largest of 5 fortresses built during the Derg War. The Frey out here patrol these lands and ensure there's a safe buffer between people like us and them. It's actually a source of some friction in their society. The Instaria don't like being the only ones forced to live in what most consider a wasteland. A breeze picked up. All around them, leaves rustled, whispering to one another. A gentle sound. Across the field, the pillars of cook fires began to lose shape, blurring as they blew to the south.
"I don't know why the Instaria complain. It's really quite beautiful," Malcolm said.
Wraith stood, taking his snare with him. He cut down a small tree, pruned off the branches, and laid it across the opening of a tiny path. The trail through the brush was the perfect size for a rabbit, and little pebble droppings were everywhere. He hung the loop down from it, keeping the noose off the ground. Then he stuck pruned branches in the dirt before the hoop, ensuring that the rabbit would need to jump over them and would land in the snare.
"Bless me with 3 rabbits, Wogan, and I'll make a burnt offering of the last one to you."
"Bargaining with the gods again?" Malcolm asked. "Wouldn't it be more enticing to offer the first rabbit in order to prove your faith?"
"Wogan isn't a god, he's a spirit, a guardian of forests."
"There's a difference."
"I know you were a slave for a long time, but did they keep you trapped in a hole, too?"
"Is there a difference?
Is there a difference between a cow and a goat? Between the sun and the moon? Tetlin's witch. I swear, don't."
Malcolm's tone was abrupt and serious. Wraith paused.
"Since when are you against swearing?"
"I'm not. Just choose another name to swear by."
"Why?
Using a god or a spirit would be far worse. Call me superstitious."
"You? Malcolm of the Wrist, who scoffs at the idea of manes and leshies? You're afraid of the Tetlin witch?"
Malcolm didn't reply. He pulled his legs up tight to his chest and stared out at the hill and the walled village of the Dáil. "You know, rather than praying for rabbits, we could just check out the Dáil. It worked out all right at the roadhouse."
"You call that all right? Did you forget Donny?"
"What if I promise to keep my mouth shut?" Malcolm asked.
"Is that possible?"
Malcolm frowned. "I meant no storytelling. Aren't dolls supposed to be generous to strangers? Isn't that a thing? They'll at least give us a little to eat, right?"
"Maybe. If they follow tradition. Hard times among the clans these days. And it could be dangerous for us. What if someone from the roadhouse is there? A group of traders might welcome the god-killer, but dolls are different. Dolls have chieftains tasked with keeping everyone safe, men who agreed to live by the Frey's rules and force others to do the same."
"But I don't see that we have a choice. We can't keep running like this, especially without food."
"Our only hope is to keep moving south and stay ahead of the Frey. We do that, and we'll stay alive."
"No man can escape death," Malcolm said. "But it's how we run that defines us. And aren't you getting a bit..."
Malcolm stopped, and his eyes narrowed as he stared at the sunny field between them and the Dáil.
"What?" Wraith whispered, trying to see what Malcolm was looking at.
"I think they are women."
Malcolm pointed out a pair of figures coming from the Dáil and heading their way. They were women. The taller one wore a long black dress that made tramping through the tall grass a struggle. She had wavy black hair that whipped behind her, exposing a lovely face.
Beside her walked a girl with painted markings, short hair, and a battered cape dyed the color of red clay. Bounding by their side was a white wolf.
"It's just a forest, only trees,"
Persephone assured herself as they approached the meadow's edge. "But people have died inside it." Her son had been killed while hunting deer with his two best friends, both able men, and an entire war party had accompanied Reglan.
"I should have brought someone along. I could have asked Conniger to send Sackett as an escort, but what would I have said? I'm afraid of the forest, so I want to borrow the shield of the chieftain. Oh, and by the way, the reason I'm going into the woods that terrify me is because I feel it's important to talk to a tree. For the good of the doll, of course."
"Yeah, that would go over well." The murky forest grew larger as they approached. Persephone had hoped the trees would appear smaller than she remembered. Things usually shrank when people grew older. The steps of the lodge used to seem mammoth, and the stone foundation it sat on had been a veritable cliff when she was a child. But the trees hadn't gotten smaller. If anything, they looked bigger. Since her son's death, Persephone hadn't left the doll, and after Reglan died, she rarely left Sarah and Delwyn's roundhouse. But the forest was another matter, and she hadn't entered it, not since.
"It's just a forest. Only trees."
When Persephone was 7, she and the other children would goad one another to venture deeper into the woods and touch certain trees. Everyone managed to reach the white birch, but only she and her best friend Arya had managed to touch the elm beyond the shade line. Then one of the children, perhaps Sarah, dared them both to touch the black tree. No one knew what sort of tree it was. They could barely see it from where they stood in the safe warmth of the afternoon sun. Sarah, if it had been Sarah, hadn't been serious. Everyone knew it. That tree was too deep. Farther even than where the grass turned to ferns. It lived where the undergrowth loomed and darkness reigned. The whole idea was silly. Crazy, really. And Persephone had laughed. Choosing that tree was a sort of revenge because they'd all been humiliated by Persephone's and Arya's courage.
"It couldn't have been Sarah," Persephone concluded. "We're so close now, and I hated the little girl who made that dare."
She hated her because Persephone had laughed, but Arya hadn't. It didn't matter that Arya was 2 years older. They were best friends, and had always agreed on everything. But this time was different. Arya had taken Persephone's hand and said, "We'll do it together." Her friend had been serious. Persephone, shocked at the words and frightened by the prospect, ripped her hand away. She could still see the disappointment in Arya's eyes, inside of which Persephone's reflection became smaller.
"Just me, then," Arya had said, disappointed.
Persephone had tried to stop her, saying it was stupid and dangerous. She wanted to believe her attempts to hold Arya back stemmed from fear for her friend's life. The truth was she didn't want to be second best. She wanted to be brave, but felt like a coward, embarrassed and ashamed. Arya had entered the forest alone. No one believed she'd do it, but as they watched, the small girl crept deeper and deeper into the branches and leaves until the underbrush swallowed her. They waited, then called out, but she didn't answer. Hours passed, or so it seemed. To children, time, like the sizes of things, wasn't constant. Persephone eventually panicked and ran back to the doll to get help.
"If only I had run the other way. If only I had run into the forest to save my friend, everything would have turned out so different."
She'd gone only part way up the hill when Arya reappeared. Persephone had heard the cheers behind her. Some called Arya crazy, but there was also awe in their jibes, and she had laughed with them. Persephone watched from a distance, didn't join them. She couldn't meet her best friend's eyes, couldn't face seeing herself grow smaller still. Instead, she walked home alone. Arya had called out. Persephone pretended not to hear. Arya shouted she was sorry, but Arya had nothing to be sorry for. After that, Persephone avoided Arya. Every time they saw each other, Persephone was reminded of her failure and cowardice. A decade had gone by before she spoke with her friend again. The occasion had been Persephone's wedding, and Arya, who was pregnant at the time, stood in the long line to congratulate the new bride. Like all the others, Arya took Persephone's hand, and their eyes met. She expected to see anger, maybe even hatred. But neither waited for her. All she saw was the unbridled happiness of a married woman waiting for the birth of her first child, and who wanted the same joyful life for her childhood friend. Arya had forgiven Persephone, even if Persephone hadn't forgiven herself. She had made plans to go to Arya after the baby was born, using the birth as an excuse to visit. She'd apologize for all the years of avoidance and bring a gift for the baby. They would laugh again, the way they used to, and all the troubles of the past would fade away. That day never came. Arya died giving birth to her son, Gifford. Maybe the boy inherited his mother's courage. Cursed by the gods, twisted into a tragic wretch, he'd proved them all wrong by living. With awkward hands, he did the impossible over and over, fashioning clay masterpieces that were the envy of every artisan. In his own way, Gifford dared to touch the black tree every day. Arya died before Persephone could say she was sorry. Sorry for ignoring Arya for years. Sorry for pretending not to hear her shouts when walking home. Sorry for not running into the trees to save her, but mostly for not accepting her friend's hand and going into the forest. It had been 3 decades, and Persephone was finally ready to touch the black tree. "You live out there, don't you?" Persephone asked Tsuri while her wolf raced ahead of them. Mina paused to smell something before darting off again.
"Yes, Mom."
Tsuri walked with long, easy strides, swinging Tura's wooden staff, which was slightly shorter and infinitely older than the girl.
"How'd you do it? Live all by yourself, I mean. Aren't you scared?"
"I'd be more frightened of living where you do."
Tsuri looked back over her shoulder at the doll. "I don't live alone. There are over 200 families on the doll." Tsuri laughed.
"Did I say something funny?"
"Do you know how many families live in the forest, Mom?"
"Families live in the forest?"
"Oh, yes. There are far too many to count. Squirrels, foxes, badgers, spiders, rabbits, hedgehogs, snakes, deer, raccoons, bluebirds, woodpeckers, moose, grouse, owls, weasels, moles, skunks, doves, butterflies." "Can't forget the butterflies."
"But they aren't people."
"Exactly," Tsuri said with a wink. "You're starting to see my point, aren't you, Mom? I mean, who wouldn't prefer a family of bunnies, robins, or raccoons as neighbors? And look at the place you live. So much wood decaying around you. Dead bodies aren't a suitable home. The best neighbor you can have is a tree. A living tree. They listen more than they talk, provide shade on hot days, give you food and shelter, and don't ask for anything in return."
"What about the dangers? Bears, for example."
"Oh,
Suri said, with a knowing nod of her head.
Well, we'd have something to worry about if we were a couple of lilies.
How's that?
Bears love to eat lilies. Berries, ants, and mice.
If you're not one of those, bears can be quite nice.
Playful, but also known to cheat.
Does that include the brown?
Persephone asked, with more bitterness than she had intended.
Grin is different.
They were at the bottom of a hill, entering a pretty hardwood grove that was still open enough to be dappled by plenty of sunlight. This was where the bright birches of Persephone's youth had grown. They were still there, chalk-white trunks of peeling bark and fresh, bright leaves. Looking to the left, Suri did a little twirl and waved. Persephone didn't see anyone.
Who are you waving to?
Huh?
Oh, there's a holly bush over there I had a conversation with on the way in.
She lowered her voice.
Normally, I don't care much for bushes. Most are mean and standoffish, with their thorns and prickles.
I suppose they have their reasons. I mean, absolutely everyone steals from them. But that holly was nice. With that, Suri strode onward. They passed the birches, and the undergrowth changed to fiddlehead ferns. The elm tree had been near there, but after so many years, she couldn't pick it out. Persephone's steps slowed until, without realizing, she stopped. A few steps later, Suri also halted, as did Mina. Both of them looked back at Persephone with a puzzled expression. Persephone stood with her hands clenched as she stared at the dark trees ahead. From this point, the land sloped upward. The undergrowth and the forest canopy cast everything in shadow.
This is as far as I've ever been.
Suri started to laugh, but covered her mouth.
Sorry.
No, you're right to laugh. It's stupid.
I've travelled north as far as Alan Rist, and south to the Blue Sea. I've visited all the Dals, and have even seen Mount Mador.
From a distance, of course.
And although I've looked at the forest every morning from my bedroom window, I haven't gone in. Not beyond where the sunlight shines. Not that I need it to. I don't hunt or cut trees, and there's nothing of interest inside.
The tattoos above Suri's eyes lifted in shock, but Persephone was too scared to be polite.
They're just trees, aren't they?
Persephone said the words to reassure herself, but the fear was still there. The old terror clawed, tightening her stomach and making it hard to breathe.
Even a child, even a 7-year-old girl knows that. Good!
Suri took 3 more strides, but Persephone still hadn't moved.
Still coming.
Can I ask a favor?
Persephone reached out.
Would you take my hand?
Suri narrowed her eyes and glanced at Mina skeptically, then shrugged.
Okay.
Suri crossed back through the fiddleheads. The delicate plants quivered and bobbed at her passing, but she never stepped on any. Persephone felt the mystic's tentative clasp.
Lead on, Arya, Persephone said. Who's Arya?
A girl I used to know.
Suri looked up.
You're very odd, aren't you, Mom?
Chapter 8 Asking the Oak. Magda was an ancient oak tree that grew in a glade on a hill in the deep forest. It was said she could tell the future and would answer any question posed beneath her leaves. For most people, asking the oak was a simple thing, an afternoon's walk. For Persephone, the trip took a day and a night, and cost more than one life. The Book of Brin. In her mind, Persephone always imagined that the forest beyond the black tree was a gaping maw of darkness filled with malevolent demons, ghosts, and cruel row that ate people, starting with their faces. Stories told on winter nights, spent in a circle around the lodge fire,